Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Yes, welcome back indeed. Taylor Swift, she is going to be in Dublin this week for three historic stadium shows. It follows the ticket sales storm last year. Do you remember this? It was dubbed by the Swifties as the Great War of 2023. They're very subtle fans. And for every myth about Swift, there's something iffy about her continental drift. And that is as bad and as unsubtle as many of her lyrics are going to be. We're going to find out now. In our conversation, is she a force for good or just a force for money? But one thing you cannot deny, she writes sensational pop tunes. I think she really does. Here's one of the thousands of mega mix mashups of her hit songs. It'll educate some of the people texting us who say they don't know any of her songs. But it'll also serve, I think, to get us into the mood. I'm excited about it. And writer Amy O'Connor is with us to unpick the cult of the Taylorian regime that Taylor and her parents have built. Amy O'Connor, are you a Swiftie for some?
I'm not a Swiftie, and I heard you call me a Swiftie earlier, no, I don't.
An RT correction must now be made.
Before I contact my lawyers. No, I'm not a Swiftie. I'm kind of more Swiftie curious. So, I'm a woman in my early 30s. She's been around since I was a teenager. Yeah. So I feel like I consume a lot of her music. I'm partial to some of her more boppy songs. Not really like, not the sad COVID stuff.
Agree.
That's not for me. Not for me.
Not the cardigan-y
things. No, not for me at all. But
taking herself seriously then, wasn't
exactly,
she?
Exactly. Yeah. She wanted the Grammys. But anyway, we'll go to that later.
Yes.
But I mean, I went to see the Eras tour in the cinema last year. Yeah.
Okay.
But on my own on a Friday afternoon. And it was really great crack. Like I was like, I get it now. She is like you were saying earlier. She's kind of like Bruce for young ones.
Yeah, she really is.
Yeah.
And she's gone through all these kind of changes and so on. There's already messages coming in here saying, I love Taylor, but I become a Swiftie by default as my daughter adores her. There's lots of mammies in this position. She's an amazing artist and lyricist. And how could anyone begrudge the level of joy at the concerts, not to mention an incredibly astute businesswoman, which we will get into.
Yes.
Because she started, how does this begin, this whole thing?
So it begins, she was born in Pennsylvania, not exactly, you know, country and Western vibe, but she's the daughter of a Merrill Lynch stockbroker, grew up in a Christmas tree farm, but then moved to this kind of like mahoosive gaff, kind of like something out of Father of the Bride.
Her marketing says Christmas tree farm, like it's an estate.
Not millions of acres, but
I looked up her house yesterday, it looks like the Home Alone mansion.
Yes, exactly, her Father of the Bride is always my...
Good.
Just those lovely big American houses you see in films. Yeah. But that's where she was brought up. Very upper middle class
her
sort of upbringing.
Was also from an extremely rich family. Her father, as in her Taylor's granddad, owned a construction company. And her mum lived between Texas and Singapore. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
I went very deep. But there's lots of money in the background.
Lots of money in the background. And she, when she was young, she kind of got into country music, and then the whole family decided to up sticks and take her to Nashville, and they were like, we're going to make this happen. She was 14 and she was signed as a staff songwriter with Sony, which is like, I mean, in fairness, even if you're really wealthy, like you still have to have the talent. Yeah. So she was a really precocious young talent, obviously.
14 year old girl. She's the youngest ever.
What
is that? Do you know what that means? She's literally...
I imagine she's in the studio working with other artists and
writing
stuff.
Other people's songs.
I think that's what a staff songwriter would imply. Yeah.
She's amazing.
She's incredibly talented, yeah.
There's lots of funny stories when she goes to Nashville and she waltzes around school telling everyone, I'm going to be a major star. They all kind of...
Right.
They all laugh at her, basically. And what's going on then in her life in Nashville? I think her mum is like sending CDs all around the place. They really want to make it as a family.
Yeah, I mean, her mum was total momager kind of mode. And, you know, but everyone got on board. Like the dad, you know, like he was obviously a super successful finance guy, but the whole family, it became their project. So I think it was in around 2006 she released her first single, which was Tim McGraw. And that was in her kind of pickup truck song kind of era. You know what I mean? It was very like kind of bog standard country and western stuff. And that was her
really
vibe.
Country.
But what they kind of unearthed was that there is a huge, you know, there was a huge fan base that wasn't being served, which was teenage girls.
Yeah.
So she became kind of a huge crossover success. It was her second album, Fearless, which was the one that really kind of propelled her to some kind of stardom. It sold millions of copies in the States and it actually won Album of the Year at the Grammys. And that was kind of, that was her in motion then.
That's
she kind
the landing.
Of, that was the landing.
A little tippet just from her teenage years. And she is releasing music at this stage. I love this. This from the Sunday Times. At 16, Taylor Swift bought a Lexus SC430 convertible, the car driven by Regina George, Mean Girl.
That's
in
brilliant.
Mean Girls. So she had real confidence.
She had real
she
confidence.
Sassy.
Yeah, that's actually remarkably on brand for her as well, I think, isn't it? Yeah.
So the whole thing is a plan, really, to make her the biggest star in the world.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether that's a good or bad thing, They do succeed.
They were hyper motivated and ambitious, yeah.
Big Machine is the name of the record label assigned to. The family are so entrenched that the dad buys 5% of the company, mm-hmm. $500,000, and the mother goes to work there.
There you go.
So, I don't know what the... There is another boy. There's one other child, isn't there?
Austin, yes.
Okay,
Austin, who I think works for the Swift Corporation now. Yeah,
right,
yeah,
so
yeah.
He's managed to stay kind of...
I think
radar.
He tried to be an actor, maybe briefly. Oh, didn't work out. Yeah, yeah.
Wow, a rare failure for the Swift family. What happens next? So she is now a Grammy-winning artist.
She's a Grammy-winning
country star.
Country star, country yeah. pop, but still very much country in that pop. Country sphere. So she put, you know, she puts out other albums, and she kind of slowly but surely starts moving to pop. So she's got Speak Now, she's got Red, but in 2014 she releases 1989, and she kind of just ditches country, goes full pop, and that I think is what kind of propels her to superstardom. Where like I think your mum could have feasibly heard of her, you know what I mean? Like she was, you know what I mean? Like she was a proper megastar. And yeah, at that point it was just bye-bye country, hello.
And selling herself into the generation by calling it 1989.
Exactly, exactly. So? Millennials, yeah.
And brilliant pop tunes. Shake It Off, we just heard. That's
Shake
from,
It Off, Blank Space,
Blank
Style,
Space.
Yeah, Bab Lodge. Like it's kind of, I think it's probably her best album. It's just wall-to-wall
for
bangers.
Sure. It's her
yeah.
hot fuss.
Exactly.
Killer.
Yes,
speak
it's
things.
Her
it's
hot
okay
fuss.
For people of our generation. loads of messages coming in. Someone is already saying, Derek McDonald in Dundalk saying, the difference between Taylor Swift and Springsteen is that Bruce sings all his songs live, no miming. I mean... She's wrong there.
I think he's yeah. definitely wrong. I mean, I saw the Eras tour in the cinema and no, she, I mean, there's backing
very
tracks and stuff, but she is singing. She's singing and she's stomping around, you know, unlike Bruce, she's having to do choreography as well. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's a pretty impressive feat.
Oh, we're taking all the Springsteen fans.
I know. I know. I forgot where I am. I'm on 2FM right now.
This is not 2FM. You know, so she does all the pop stuff and it's about kind of normal breakup songs and wanting to go out with the prince and
it's all the
football
usual,
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
But then there's another version of Taylor Swift, which is where she becomes gigantic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, I think you've come up with this whole reality show.
Yeah, well, I think that there is an element of reality show-ness to Taylor Swift, right? Because she's constantly in feuds with other celebrities. She,
over
you know,
very small things.
Over very small, minor things. Yeah. Minor slights a lot of the time. Mm. But, you know, she kind of, she gets into feuds. She slags her exes. She dishes the dirt on her relationships. And I think, you know, you can say she's a brilliant songwriter, but I think part of the appeal is every time an album comes out, diving in, figuring out what song's about who, you know, deciphering the lyrics and stuff. And I think that there's, it kind of just reminds me of Love Island or something, you know what I mean? Like
yeah.
just in terms of how people kind of voraciously consume it and, you know, kind of take on her enemies or her exes and stuff. It's kind of interesting.
It's like her fans became so obsessed with her brand, she just decides, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to feed them little titbits.
Absolutely,
get them
and
into
it
a
works.
Frenzy.
Yes.
All the time. I love that idea.
Yeah,
that,
but I
of
think,
the reality show.
Yeah.
It never occurred to me before. So Amy, you're like a lecturer in Taylor
like
Swift,
a lecturer.
Swiftology.
Yes. Yeah.
And just to people who don't know, what do you mean by what goes on in her lyrics that it's like a reality TV show for her fans?
Well, I mean, she just openly slags people. So okay, take for instance her most recent album. She's got a song on there called "Thank You, Amy." Amy spelled A-I-M-E-E. Okay. And she's got the K and the I and the M capitalized. And that is about Kim Kardashian. So she all these, like, she just drops all these little nuggets and kind of Easter eggs, I suppose.
Coded
abuse, exactly. And if you know, you know, you know, that kind of way. And I think fans get a lot of, get a kick out of.
So it's not just the ex-boyfriends.
Ex-boyfriends. No, 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 certainly not. Like, I mean, she wrote Bad Blood. That's about, well, allegedly about Katy Perry, who she was in a years-long feud with.
Why were they fighting?
They were friends, and then I believe that Katy Perry poached some of her backup dancers and made
like,
and I think,
we said, very minor thing.
Exactly. I think they went on tour there, and then it was like, it was war. Mm. Yeah.
Now, to keep the kind of reality show plotline going, mm-hmm. with the Katy Perry story, they make up.
Yes.
And she appears in one of her videos.
In You Need to Calm Down, which is not one of her high points, I wouldn't say, musically.
I don't think so.
No, that wouldn't be for me now. But yeah, they make up. Like, they were both probably at a slightly lower ebb at that point. Taylor's obviously bounced back. Katy Perry still hasn't quite gotten to where she was like 10 or 12 years ago, but they were at a slightly low ebb, and I think they knew this will generate a load of positive headlines and coverage, so let's appear in the music video for both of them. So
Katy Perry, which you said was also bigger, had made more money than Taylor Swift for a time. Now, yeah, she's eclipsed her since.
Mm-hmm. Oh, big time.
Definitely
a
feud is involved in that.
Yes.
Nicki Minaj, this is a fascinating feud.
Nicki Minaj, yes. So I mean, I don't know if people remember, but this would be in about 2014-15, and it was when the MTV VMA Awards were announced. I mean, this is the VMAs, we're not talking about the Oscars or anything here, but Nicki Minaj's video for Anaconda wasn't included in the shortlist for video of the year. And she went on Twitter to kind of complain about it, because in fairness, that year Anaconda was probably one of the most viral videos. It definitely
was
one of the most talked about, definitely kind of a pop culture moment, and it wasn't included. And Nicki Minaj said, you know, if my video had had perhaps like skinny bodies, maybe I would have been in the lineup. And Taylor Swift perceived that as a dig at her, because her video for Bad Blood was in the lineup. And Taylor Swift replied to her and was like, how do you know that one of the men did not take your space? This is not like you not to support other women. And it kind of blew up into this big thing. But actually, people were saying to Taylor, like, you've kind of missed the point here. You know, Nicki Minaj's broader point was that black female artists maybe don't get the same kudos or acclaim as their white counterparts. So then Taylor Swift had to obviously apologise. And then lo and behold, a few months later at the VMAs, they performed together. So it was kind of amazing damage control.
She kind of conquers. But then there's a separate Nicki Minaj thing, because she's going out with Matty Healy, who says
that was actually about Ice Spice.
Oh, that was specifically about
her. Okay. Yes. So last year, Taylor Swift was having a little fling with Matty Healy, who people might know is the lead singer of the 1975. And footage emerged of him on a podcast, and he was making kind of really horrible racist jokes about Ice Spice, who was kind of a young up-and-coming rapper.
He's an ass at the best of times.
Yeah, anyway, kind of. Yeah. And he's kind of intentionally provocative, you know, bit of a dose. And he made these jokes anyway. And then people were like, Taylor, are you going to say anything to your man about these jokes that he's made? Again, lo and behold, she springs into action, and Ice Spice is put on a remix of Karma, I think it is. And they become, you know, Ice Spice is part of the squad. They go to the Super Bowl together. So like, all, you know, just amazing damage control and damage limitation. But that's kind of what she's expert at, is managing these backlashes and kind of getting out ahead of stuff.
She's kind of brilliant. There are loads of other feuds.
There's a lot of feuds. I mean, like, she said before, it's not real if someone appears to never have any issues with anyone. I have my friends, I have enemies. And like, a lot of people don't have enemies. So that's quite, It's quite a strong statement to make. I have my enemies. But she does. I mean, like, we won't go through them all, obviously. But like Kanye West, Kim Kardashian, that was obviously a huge
one.
That was a big one.
Barack
Obama called Kanye West an ass after he... or jackass. But even people like, you know, she's had beef with Calvin Harris, who was one of her exes. Mm-hmm. It was all about who wrote This Is What You Came For. Jake Gyllenhaal, of course, he's the subject of All Too Well, one of her exes. So
I'm with Taylor on that one. All Too Well, by the way, she did a 10-minute version of this.
Yes, she did.
And actually, she's talking here on the Graham Norton Show. It doesn't do many interviews, Taylor Swift.
Doesn't do many interviews. She did an interview in December just gone, and that was her first interview in 4 years, I believe.
She was sitting next to Bono.
Yeah.
I think the one, because the All Too Well, which is about Jake Gyllenhaal, and I think this is her describing the kind of campaign by her own fans that she had to relent to herself.
Okay, how do I shorten this? So basically, All Too Well was a song that came out originally on an album called Red, which came out in 2012. I always loved this song. It was never a single, but the fans really loved this song. And I had made the mistake of saying in an interview the truth, which is that it had started out as a 10-minute song with like 6 or 7 extra verses, and we had had to cut it down to the sort of 4.5-5 minute length that it ended up. My fans would not let it go. They were like, I'd be doing an interview for something else, albums later, and they'd be like, where's the 10-minute version? Where is it? So basically, for the re-record, I was like, I am going to put out the 10-minute version. I'm just gonna show them what it was.
The fans forcing her hand. And she does the 10-minute version during this tour.
She does, yeah. Actually, you know, initially I was a little bit skeptical, like, who needs a 10-minute song? But it's actually kind of good.
Is it?
I don't mind it. Yeah,
right,
yeah.
Very good. There's loads of reaction coming in, by the way, but we want to talk about more and more stuff because people are kind of like preempting some of it. We have the reality show element and how she involves all her feuds and stuff in her lyrics. She goes political as well.
Yes. So she's like, for years, she was not political. She was kind of a subscriber to that Republicans buy sneakers too kind of belief, you know. So yeah, like, just stays really apolitical. Also, in fairness, it was probably informed by her background in country music because, yes, of course, the Dixie Chicks were kind of one of the first people to get cancelled, really. But, yeah, you know, they condemned George Bush's invasion of Iraq, and their careers were kind of, they were in the wilderness
because
for a long
time after.
Because
their base is Republican.
It. Exactly, yeah, exactly. So she stayed silent.
And even in the backlash in recent years, they've had to change their name.
Chicks,
because,
exactly.
Because Dixie is a reference to the South and slavery and all of that.
Absolutely. So she avoided being political, but then I think as time went on, it became like, I think artists had to get political because things were so, yeah, divided in the States and stuff, and it just wasn't cool anymore to not express an opinion. So I think she kind of noticed that the winds were changing, and she decided to kind of slowly but surely start expressing opinions about certain stuff. So in 2014, she came out as a feminist in an interview with The Guardian. And you'll remember at that time, I think a lot of celebrities were kind of, feminism wasn't as much of a dirty word anymore. So it was kind of a safe position to take. So she came out as a feminist, and that became quite central to her brand. You know, she, in fairness to her, she did some good stuff. Like, she filed and won a sexual assault case against a DJ who had groped her.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that one.
You know, and
yeah,
she spoke about like believing victims. And I think, in fairness, she's spoken about the repeal of Roe versus Wade in the States and stuff. So she's, you know, in fairness, she's spoken out on certain things. But I think sometimes people felt it was a little bit like self-serving and kind of a bit branded. So sometimes she's kind of, it almost, she's weaponized the girls supporting girls sort of thing. So right, if you weren't with her, then you're against her, and that's not feminist, you know, that kind of way.
And that's kind of where the squad comes to prominence.
The squad,
how,
yeah,
the squad is what, or just her elite collection of
her elite
celebrity
collection
endorsements
of models. Yeah, so it was kind of after 1989 or around that time, suddenly she wouldn't go to an event without being flanked by like 7 or 8
mega famous people,
mostly models and pop stars. So people like Cardi Kloss and Cara Delevingne and Selena Gomez and stuff. And I think initially it was kind of like girl squad, girls supporting girls, feminism, you know, yay.
But commercial feminism,
exactly,
at last.
Exactly. But I think after a while, people just kind of started to find it all a little bit off-putting because it felt, just had an air of exclusivity about it. And actually, kind of in another genius PR move, she addressed it a few years. She started addressing it by diversifying the squad.
Uh-huh.
So suddenly she started hanging out with, like, you know, Serena Williams is there and Todrick Hall. And
it was initially too white. Look,
it was initially too white and too blonde and too skinny, I think.
Do you remember the time Adele trolled the squad? Wasn't that because Adele had gone off to raise her kid?
That's right.
I think she didn't win it. That's, and she's gone for years, and she emerged and says, hello, it's me again. I think she said, I also have a squad, and none of us are supermodels except in our brains.
It's just so brilliant, wasn't it? But that was the kind of mood at the time. Like, people were like, okay, we get it. You've got some friends. But she did kind of diversify it and stuff. But then a few years later, when she turned 30, she wrote a piece for Elle, you know, when there was like 30 things I learned before I turned 30. And she kind of acknowledged all the backlash to it. But she framed it as like, listen, when I was in school, you know, I had no friends. I was often sitting alone at lunch. And once I had friends, once people wanted to be friends with me, I obviously, you know, jumped for joy. But now I know that wasn't the right thing to do. But she kind of flipped the script, generated some sympathy. People are like, oh, poor Taylor, she's just insecure. So she's kind of She's so good. She's kind of a PR genius.
And she got the LGBT community, You Need to Calm Down. That's what that whole song is about, isn't it?
Yes,
and
it is.
All the queers folk, Ellen DeGeneres, all the gays she could find
all the famous
piled
gays.
Into the one video. So she wins that audience and that's on, and they come along to all her shows. It's like she's constantly looking for what's the next group I don't have.
Exactly that.
It? Country, exactly. Pop, right, feminism, now we'll get the gays. And she probably was missing straight men, which is that why she's dating
maybe,
a football star?
Exactly, that's why she's dating Travis Kelce, and that's why she works with the lads from The National.
Speaking of politics, she did endorse Joe Biden in the 2020 election, which was regarded as significant, and the Democrats are literally hoping that she does the same thing. That was one of their great hopes. It's unbelievable power.
It's kind of crazy power. Now, it's funny because in some ways you might wonder if it's a little overstated, because back in 2018 she also endorsed a Democratic senator in or like a candidate for the Senate in Tennessee. But I mean, that didn't do anything. Yeah, the Republican.
He didn't win.
No. The incumbent Republican still won quite handily. So you wonder how much influence like she actually has when it comes down to it. But I understand the Democrats wanting to court her.
For sure, it'd be world news.
Absolutely, 100%.
She did it around the summer. It's still come a couple of months to go, but her tour goes till December, so she might be thinking
about
that.
She might be busy. Yeah.
Yeah, and also, she led a drive to get young people to register to vote, and that was successful.
That was, unfairness.
Literally hundreds of thousands.
Exactly.
Of young people
because
she said so. There's loads of reaction coming in. At the political point, we go in here. As a middle-aged male, I'm outraged at the imbalance on display and all this Tay-Tay stuff. Oasis, cigarettes and alcohol. For some balance, please, says Connor, who mustn't have been around when I played Liam Gallagher yesterday. I talked about Liam Gallagher, and I talk about football so much at the moment that I'm going to be divorced actually any minute. This person says, I'm a new age Swiftie. I'm going to see Taylor on Saturday night with my daughter and my four granddaughters. Can't wait. Don't tell too many people, because that's six tickets, and the Swifties will actually get you for that as well. Not a Swiftie, but I'm actually enjoying the hype. A break from the dirge. The dirge must be EU commissioner roles and who's going to be the Minister of Finance, I'm assuming. It's blissfully frivolous. Don't mind the begrudgers. Play the 10-minute version. Well, we wouldn't have time for that. Someone just randomly says, Love Story is a class song. I think lots of embarrassing things happened on the live shows during that. Are there proposals and things during Love Story?
I would imagine so, yeah.
Did it happen on the concert film that you saw?
It did not. They would not have seeded any of the spotlight to anyone else in that film.
I'm merely Swiftie adjacent, but I don't understand all the hating here this morning. Don't bother fighting the Taylor Swift phenomenon, folks. Get on board and enjoy, says Jonah Dublin 7. It's good advice.
And listen, I'm not on board. It's just that there is, I think you were saying earlier, there is just a little sting in the tail with Taylor Swift, you know. So I think you can enjoy her music, and like, in fairness, the joy that she brings to mums, kids, everyone, it's kind of amazing. So I won't begrudge people their fun over the weekend, but
it's pop tunes. I know she wants to be taken seriously in some of her things, but she's really good at singing live.
She's really good at singing live. She puts on a good show, and they're undeniable bangers. So, you know, in fairness,
undeniable bangers.
Yeah.
Let's take it. There's a big feud of all feuds is the re-recording of her albums. It's an extraordinary thing she does.
Yes.
I don't fully understand this story. Why is she re-recording stuff she's already done and putting it out?
Because she doesn't own the masters. So basically it was Scooter Braun, who was a big time music manager, would have had, I think, Justin Bieber, possibly Demi Lovato, other people like that on his books. And he purchased the masters because she refused to sign. I believe refusing to sign another contract with Big Machine Records, who she had been with,
which her dad owned
5%
of.
Exactly. And he purchased her. He wouldn't let her buy her masters back, so she decided to re-record all her albums. So she's on this thing now where once a year a new Taylor's version of one of her old albums
comes
out. So
it's like an old album like Red, Red and Taylor's version in brackets.
Yes.
And her fans know that this is the one she'll make money out of.
Yes.
So they'll ignore the old version to stop them making money. And they do this.
I think they do this, but I mean, I wonder how many actually do this. Because you know what I mean? If I'm listening to 1989, I'm probably not listening
really
to Taylor's version. I'm listening to Scooter's version.
There are even conspiracies on TikTok at the moment that because the 29th of June was the date that she says her music was stolen, in inverted commas, that she's going to announce on the Dublin stage this Saturday the latest album, which is...
Reputation.
Reputation is the one that will be due. And that she might do that in Dublin because of connection. Because it's owned by Shamrock Holdings, is the name of of the company that, again, she alleges stole her music. They just bought it.
Everything that you just, it sounds like QAnon.
Yes, it is. It's, everything is decoded.
Yeah, completely.
Till nothing makes any sense at all. I love the incidental story that Joe Alwyn, I mentioned earlier, because he co-wrote some of the songs with her while they were going out. He's made, according to reports, $2.3 million as of March of this year on Spotify alone.
That's mad.
In the royalties. So
at least someone's making money off Spotify.
Doesn't need to do anything. And he's by default won a Grammy. Because
because he'd be one of very good.
Isn't that something? Yeah. So it pays to go out and
pays to go
out with her. We'll take a break, will we? We take a quick break and we'll come back. 51551 is the text.
Email Oliver at rte.ie.